Thank you very much, Dean. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this special session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I just have some preliminary matters, but first, what I'm going to do is ask our marshal to call us to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Gaitis, and Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Again, good morning, everybody. We're so happy to have you here, and we're thankful to the University of Minnesota for hosting us, and we're especially grateful for the faculty, staff, and most importantly, students who are joining us today. I'd like to also thank counsel for, if I can see you around the corner there you are, for participating in oral arguments in this venue. I think it's very valuable for our students to be able to see, and we're grateful for that. And we look forward to your arguments and conversing with you about today's case. And again, just a final note, we hope we will end proceedings here. We'll stay here just for Q&A immediately afterwards to talk about whatever you might want to talk about, other than obviously this case. So with that, let's turn to today's business. Today is Thursday, October 26, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar today. Two of those cases are non-oral, meaning that they are submitted on the briefs only without oral argument. And the third one is an oral case, and I'm going to begin by calling that one now. We are hearing arguments this morning in A23-0569, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Patrick Martin Orman, Appellant. Counsel, again, as you know, we are conducting this proceeding here at the University of Minnesota Law School. The argument is also being live streamed, which is something our court just started doing this fall for even our in-person arguments. After the argument, an audio recording only of this, these arguments will be on our website, not a video recording. As is our custom, it's oral only. As you know, counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. The marshal will be running the clock, and so pay attention to that. We can't really see it. If it's like that, can you both see it, counsel?
Yes.
Okay, then we can also. Thank you, Marshall. And when each of you begins your principal argument, if you could please state your name and the party you represent for the record, if you have any preferences on how we should address you or any person in the case, please let us know. Otherwise, we look forward to hearing from you both. And with that, we are ready for you, counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Justin Duffy, D-U-F-F-Y, with the Law Office of John Lunig, on behalf of appellant Patrick Orman. The pretrial motion that's at issue in this appeal was submitted to the district court on stipulated evidence. In view of the stipulated evidence that was submitted, the district court clearly erred in some important factual findings that were made, and once those clearly erroneous factual findings are corrected for, there was no valid basis for the stop of Mr. Orman's vehicle. And while it may be true that a district court's findings of fact are generally given great deference, that deference is not unlimited. And when you look at various pieces of the evidence that was stipulated to and submitted, it becomes clear that there was clear error in this case. And first, I want to talk about the district court's findings of fact that are clearly contradicted by the squad video that was submitted as part of the evidence. The law enforcement vehicle that was involved in this had a dash camera that recorded some of the driving conduct that was involved. And the district court had found that appellant's vehicle was weaving within its lane and that it had nearly struck a curb at some point as the officer was following it. But those findings of fact are not only unsupported, but are also directly contradicted by that video. If you review that video, essentially the first minute of that video, it does not show weaving within the lane, and it certainly does not show him nearly striking a curb.
Can I ask this, counsel? We have watched the video, and I just want to explain. So as I understand, and especially as I look at the map that you submitted as an exhibit of what happens here. So a police officer is stopped. There's kind of a more major, like high, I guess a median, like two-way highway type thing, Highway 61. And then the driver drives out and turns right onto that road, right? And then the police officer also then turns onto that road, follows that person for a period of time. It wasn't clear to me, what you're talking about is then a police officer's description of the driving conduct that the officer observed during those travels. And it wasn't clear to me from the record when the video turns on relative to that driving conduct. You know, the report talks about, you know, and here saw this, and around 24th Street saw that, but it wasn't clear to me to how the district court judge or how we in reviewing it, which you ask us to do to find whether it's supported, the findings of the court, how do we correlate where that driving occurs to say it didn't happen, which is what you're asking us to do?
Yes, and so I was not counsel at the district court. I did not control what exhibits were submitted or anything like that. But I think that in looking at the exhibits that were supplied, it shows that appellant's vehicle had come out onto the main roadway from 33rd Street. That's clear from the map that was submitted as Exhibit A. That's clear from the officer's claims in his police report, was that it was at 33rd Street. And then just—
Do you have the map in front of you?
So I do have Exhibit A, the map, yes.
Yeah, it looks to me like that the place that he came from is south of 33rd Street. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but maybe it comes out on 33rd. But in any event, go ahead.
So I guess he came out somewhere around 33rd Street. I thought that was what the officer's claim was, and I thought that the map had matched up, but that map does appear to be slightly different.
Well, the officer's report, just to clarify, says that the vehicle turned right into the right turn lane for 33rd Street. So obviously they turned onto that road before 33rd Street. You know what I mean? Because
yep.
It's talking about that. So I think it
returns. No, that's,
yeah.
That's
to
accurate,
orient
Judge.
You. Okay.
So, but you can tell when you look at the video too, because of where the divided median comes in. And looking at that in conjunction with the map and where you can see the split in the map near the top of the map there on Exhibit A, where that comes, I think that helps give us some sense of the location in which the video started at and when that began recording that conduct.
Go ahead, Counselor. Mr. Duffy, you're asking us to watch the video and conclude based on the video that the district court's factual findings about sort of what happened in the video, what the officer actually saw, were clearly erroneous. But wouldn't you agree that the video has its limitations? In other words, when the three of us watch the video, we're not able to see all of the nuances that the officer may have observed before initiating the stop.
While I would agree that you can't see what happened before the stop initiated, I think that it's clear when looking at where the video starts in conjunction with the maps that were submitted that the weaving conduct he describes and nearly striking a curb near 24th Street, that claim is not supported by the video. And the driving conduct at the time he was around 24th Street is on that video. And so I would disagree that it's not clear just in general what's shown on that video. I think that the video is very clear, and there's also no claims by the officer or anyone else that the officer saw things that the video didn't necessarily pick up. Again, this was stipulated evidence. It was just the officer's report and the video. It's not as though the officer had testified and claimed that he saw things that the video doesn't pick up or anything like that. I think that in reviewing that video, it's clear evidence that he was actually driving just fine and that it contradicts any claim that he nearly struck a curb. It shows him properly navigating the bends in the road. It shows him properly signaling a lane change and pulling over whenever the officer's emergency lights comes on. So I do think that video is clear enough and covers at least the weaving and the nearly striking a curb claim.
What about the speeding? There was also an allegation in the police report that the speed of the driver was inconsistent at times and above the posted speed limit at one point. And in fact, the district court concluded that one of the bases for the stop was speeding, which is a sufficient basis for pulling over a car.
And so while speeding may generally be a basis, the issue here that was challenged and is still being argued by the appellant is that the evidence relating to speed was not admissible and should not have been considered by the district court. And there's a statute that controls the admissibility of speed-related evidence.
So I have a question about the statute that you're arguing. You rely on statute 169.14, subdivision 10, A and B, to argue that the state didn't provide evidence regarding the speed measuring devices that would meet the statutory requirements that are set forth therein, and therefore the evidence of your client's speed was not admissible. But the first clause in subdivision 10A says, in any prosecution in which the speed of a motor vehicle is relevant. And afterwards it states that the evidence of the speed is subject to the conditions set forth there. But is this a case in which the speed is in fact relevant in the prosecution, given that the conviction is for a DWI and not speeding? How should we interpret that language? And can you point to any case law in which speed was relevant in the prosecution where it was for an offense other than driving above the speed limit?
Yeah, and so I think the important part in that statute is that it says in any prosecution in which the rate of speed of a motor vehicle is relevant. It doesn't say where it's only the sole charge or that it's necessary for a finding of, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It just talks about relevance. And here, speed is relevant because it's one of the state's claimed bases for the stop of the appellant's vehicle. So this admissibility statute, it doesn't necessarily require or only apply in a case of a speeding allegation. There was actually a speeding allegation. I believe it was count 3 in this case also. But whether he was charged with speeding or not, this statute only deals with admissibility when it's relevant.
So one question I have, you're arguing that the evidence wasn't admissible, and yet counsel below stipulated to the evidence. So what effect did the stipulation have? If the argument's that it wasn't admissible, then why stipulate to it as being part of the record properly before the district court?
So my understanding of the stipulation of the evidence didn't mean that they were agreeing necessarily that, like, the police officer's report was true. They still then argued that they disagreed and that they thought the video contradicted some of the officer's claims. The same thing goes for the speeding logs that were submitted. Just because it was stipulated to as evidence to be considered, I didn't see anywhere in there where they were stipulating to the admissibility of it and the ability for the judge to consider it. And counsel at the trial court or in the district court specifically argued against the admissibility and consideration of that speed evidence. So my view of it was that they needed to submit whatever evidence they had in order to make the arguments that they needed to make, but I don't view that as them stipulating to it being admissible and able to be considered as part of this.
And is that because, so when we think about how the process works, at some point they decide that they're going to do it on the record, counsel, and they agree to that. And then submit motions, and so at that point you're saying that the defense motion that challenged admissibility of a portion of the report, that once, even though there had been agreement, let's submit it on the record, including the police report, once they saw that motion, the state should have said, no, we're going to bring live testimony then? Is that what should have happened? I mean, it's different from stipulating to the truth of something to say that, you know, they stipulated to receipt of the police report, but then not really, not portions of the police report, right?
Yeah, so I guess my view of it is that there's stipulated facts, trials, and hearings, and there's a stipulated evidence hearing. And my view is in a stipulated facts trial, everyone is agreeing exactly what the facts are, that there's no dispute as to the facts. When there's stipulated evidence, there's an agreement that this is what we're going to submit to the judge, but you're not waiving your right to argue whatever you want to argue about that evidence that's being submitted. And each side, it's all determined what everyone's going to present. If someone wanted to present live testimony or present their evidence in some different way, I think that's incumbent on them to then ask to do that. But just because you stipulate to evidence, I don't think means that you waive your right to challenge that evidence or attack it in some way. And here, clearly, there was no waiver of the right to attack or challenge that evidence because that's exactly what was done in the district court.
In considering the totality of the circumstances here, to consider the ultimate legal question in the case, whether there was a reasonable and articulable basis for the stop, is this court required to consider, or is this court bound by the district court's legal determinations regarding the stop, that there was speeding, that there was weaving, or can this court look at the entire universe of factual findings made by the district court and make the legal conclusion that there was reasonable and articulable suspicion based on other things, such as the fact that the police report stated he was leaving a bar?
So as far as first, I think that the clear errors in the district court's findings of fact need to be corrected for. And once those are corrected for, then there was no valid basis for his stop. As far as going beyond the district court's findings of fact, I don't know that that's necessarily appropriate here, and also in particular because there was no evidence regarding inferences that the officer made or any of his conclusions as a trained law enforcement officer. So I don't think that there would be any evidence to support those sorts of inferences in the record, and I think that that would be improper. As it relates to the speeding evidence, I know that one of the things that the state has raised is that statute that we've been talking about really should only apply in order to find that someone's guilty by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But that's not actually what the cases that we have cited stand for. And I think that the state tried to mischaracterize to a certain extent what the cases that we cited stand for. Those cases, in particular Olson, the most recent one, clearly states that those cases were a discussion of admissibility under this statute, not that they were a discussion of what's necessary or what's required for a finding of guilt by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that that's an important distinction. And also the cases that the state has cited as it pertains to speeding, that those cases are distinguishable because none of those cases actually involved the challenge that was made here in the district court and that's still being made here as it pertains to admissibility. While those cases may have had speeding as a basis for the stop, no one had challenged the evidence of speeding in those cases, which I think is an important distinction here.
How does that, your theory, interrelate to just the very low standard for reasonable suspicion in order to conduct the stop, which is the only thing that's at issue, not proving speeding? It's just basically to get beyond a hunch or just a whim for a police officer to make the stop.
So the issue is that statute sets a standard for admissibility. And if that evidence is not admissible, then it can't be considered as evidence in the question that has to be answered here. So if that evidence is not admissible under the statute, it just simply can't be considered. This isn't about, if there were officer testimony that based on his training experience, he believed that the vehicle was traveling at a higher rate of speed, that might be different. But here we have a statute that sets admissibility requirements for this specific type of speed-based evidence. I see that my time is expiring. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, for all the reasons that we've argued here today, for all the reasons that we've stated in our brief, I would ask that you find the district court's findings of fact clearly erroneous and that there was no valid basis for the stop. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Alina Schwartz and I represent the respondent. The sole issue on appeal is whether the district court properly found that the traffic stop of the appellant's vehicle was legal. To determine whether the stop is legal, for specifically investigatory stop, the state has to show that there was a reasonable, articulable suspicion for the stop. To determine whether reasonable, articulable suspicion exists, the court will examine the totality of the circumstances from an objectively reasonable officer's perspective. And a trained police enforcement officer can also bring in inferences and deductions beyond the competence of untrained persons. These may include such things as personal knowledge, experience, training, the type of offense that is being suspected, the time of the offense, and the location, among other things that are relevant.
Do we know, apropos of your first comments there about the police officers' training, knowledge, et cetera, is there record evidence of that in this case?
No, but we do know that the stop was conducted by a police officer with the Hastings Police Department, and based on the police report, which was one of the exhibits. We also know that in the brief that was submitted by the appellant to the district court, they stipulated to certain requirements in statute 169.14 subdivision 10, and one of those requirements was that the officer was trained in the operation of the unit, and that is as it relates to the radar unit. So that is as far as we know about the training of the officer in this particular case, that he obviously was a peace officer with the Hastings Police Department, and that he received training in conducting the traffic stops. In this particular case, the officer acted on multiple separate facts which led him to believe that the appellant here may have been driving under the influence.
Well, let me just stop you there, because when I look at the district court's order, the district court's order seems to suggest that there were two bases for the stop, neither of which had anything to do with driving under the influence. The first basis was that when an officer observes someone weaving within their lane, they have reasonable articulable suspicion. The second is concerned speeding. You know, when an officer sees someone speeding, they can stop them. But I don't see anything in this order, as I noted, about driving under the influence. So my question is, are we bound by these two bases articulated by the district court, or in reviewing and, you know, making a determination as a matter of law, as we do, can we look at the factual findings and conclude that there was indeed reasonable suspicion of driving under the influence?
This court may review the totality of circumstances and not be limited to the findings in the district court's decision, because this court reviews de novo whether the district court's factual findings support reasonable, articulable suspicion to justify an investigatory stop. And in this particular case, there are multiple bases to justify the stop. You're correct, there is no discussion about DWI. But the discussion is specifically based on whether there is enough reasonable, articulable suspicion. The particular facts that the officer can articulate that led him to believe that there may be a criminal activity at foot. And to begin with, the first violation that the officer observed was the appellant's failure to show change of course. The officer was on routine patrol, according to his police department. He was just trying to make a turn from one lane into the lane of traffic, specifically Vermilion. It's also known as a Voyager Highway. And this is when the officer, for the first time, the officer's attention was drawn to the appellant's vehicle. And the reason why it was drawn to the appellant's vehicle is because when the appellant turned right onto Vermilion, or Voyager Highway, and there is only one way to turn on that highway, which would be right. That lane, the main lane for this highway, actually splits into a right turn lane that proceeds as a right turn lane and then exits onto the 33rd Street. And there is a main lane, of course. And what the officer observed is, as the defendant turned right, he ended up in the right turn lane and then tried to move himself from the right turn lane, specifically the lane that turns only right. He turned his course from the right turn lane into the main lane without showing any turn signal. This is a clear violation of Minnesota Statute 169.19, subdivision 4. The language is that in that statute, among others, specifically states, no person shall turn a vehicle from a direct course or move right or left upon a highway unless and until the movement can be made with reasonable safety after giving an appropriate signal in the manner herein provided.
So can I ask, counsel, what relevance to us does the, or importance to us, does the exhibit that shows the intersection have? Because, and also, I mean, your description of the police report is slightly different from the police report, because part of the argument here is that there isn't, the right lane hasn't been yet identified at the point of the turn. Like, the turn just goes onto the road and there's no right lane marked, and then down the road a piece there's a white line that creates the right-hand turn lane. And what you're describing, I think, is moving, is that at after that line started and there is a right-hand turn lane, the person, the driver moved over without signaling. But, and then the picture shows us that there's a period of time before that line actually starts. And the report says just this: a vehicle turned right into the right turn lane for 33rd Street, then changed into the main line of lane of travel. And that an argument is you can't turn right, there is no lane, right lane to turn into.
And that is correct. The council's exhibits, and that would be documents index 22 and 23, that actually show the photograph and the aerial maps, which would be exhibits 20 and 21, do show the area and do show that the main road starts splitting into the right turn lane and the main lane about 90 feet from the area where the appellant's vehicle turned onto the road. So the only omission that you will find in the argument, if one were to consider the argument of the appellant in this case, is that the officer failed to note that there is about 90 feet where the lane is only the main lane. The officer also only noted that the defendant turned into the right turn lane, and then when he moved into the main lane, he failed to show the turn signal.
Well, none of this is mentioned in the district court's order. The 90 feet, the not even the photograph that Judge Smith just referenced. So what are we to do with that? What are we to do with these additional facts?
Because the court reviews de novo the factual findings, specifically on the pretrial motions, the court may consider all of the factors that led the...
I believe our standard of review is clearly erroneous for factual findings and for questions of law de novo. Am I wrong about that?
No. And as far as the clearly erroneous, the district court did state that based on the totality of the circumstances. So I believe taking that language as a whole, the court may consider all of the evidence that was submitted to the district court. And that was the police report that noted the initial failure to show a change of signal. And this is what made the officer actually initiate the squad video recording that the court has as one of the exhibits. And
I don't know that, I'm not sure that we can tell when the recording starts from the record. Maybe we can, based on what you just said. I guess my question is about, there's some maybe arguable ambiguity in terms of what the report said and then what we see here. And since it's the state's burden to prove that it was a constitutional stop, how does that figure in if one can't really understand what the report means exactly, turn into the lane as opposed to continue in the right and then move over across when the lane develops,
I think the court will look at all the exhibits and all the reports and evidence in the record, including the police officer's reports and the video. In the report, the officer does clarify that that right turn lane was turning into the 33rd Street. Mm-hmm. The stop was performed at the 18th Street. The officer noted that the appellant's vehicle was continuously weaving during that distance, so it would be somewhere between the 33rd Street and the 18th Street, at which point the vehicle came to a stop. The officer noted that at...
Just to stop you there for a second, so are you suggesting that there is evidence that is not captured by the video that was the dash cam video that was submitted? That some stuff happened before the video started recording?
Yes, and that would be what's in the police report, because the officers, they do not initiate their squad video from the second they enter their squad video, excuse me, a squad car, to the minute that they exit it. So essentially, when someone is on routine patrol, they will initiate typically their squad video when they start following someone because they suspect something. So in this particular case, the officer was just on routine patrol. At that point, there was no reason for him to even have the cameras on. But once he noticed that there was something off, that's when the officer would typically initiate the squad video. It is not part of the record as to at which point the officer did initiate the squad video, but it's clear, and the officer does note in the police report that the vehicle was continuously weaving within its lane and almost hitting the curb at the 23rd Street. So when one is watching that squad video, you can pretty much assume that the recording is somewhere between the 33rd Street to the 18th Street, and that guidance from the police officer as to where approximately was that appellant's vehicle so close to the curb that it almost hit the curb was at around the 23rd Street. Now,
it's a lot of assumptions. That's what was kind of, you know, if there wasn't testimony, say, here's what we're looking at right now. It says, and in your brief, you cite, oh, look at, you know, minute marker XYZ in a video. But the report tells us about is when he activated his BWC, which I suppose is body worn camera. I don't know that that has any relationship to the squad camera, dash cam camera. I don't know. My understanding, but I might be wrong, but this is the absence of a record that, you know, once it's activated, it actually kind of goes backwards a little bit. We just have no way to correlate, I think, the video, which you pointed us to at specific times, with where the with the list of the driving conduct that's given in the report. Am I wrong about that?
No, but the body-worn camera would not have much relevance to it because the viewpoint of the body-worn camera and when the body-worn camera is initiated does not necessarily help the issue at hand, which is particularly the reason for the stop. But as far as the squad videos, which is not in the record, typically once the officer initiates the squad video, it goes about 30 seconds back.
And so we don't know when that happened, and we can't really place in time, unless we happen to know what it looked like. From our personal information outside the record, we can't really look at that video and say, oh, that's 24th Street. Mm-hmm. Or can we?
You can somewhat see where the main street does have some side streets going off of it. But again, yes, you would be only estimating, okay, this is the 19th Street, this is the 23rd Street, whatever that may be. But that is really irrelevant because what we know is the only conduct that the officer notes in the police report that is not captured by the squad video is the initial observation of the defendant failure to signal of going from one lane into the other lane.
Well, and the speeding. I mean, we can't see speeding from a video, right?
That is correct.
You have about a minute left. I'm hoping you can touch on that statute that we've been talking about in your remaining time.
Yes. And as far as the speeding is concerned, so the statute 169.14 and the portion of the statute that was mentioned both by the court and counsel specifically states that those requirements in subdivision 10 need to be proven in any prosecution in which rate of speed is relevant. Here, the officer indicated that he clocked the vehicle at 42 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone. We do not have to prove that the defendant was going exactly at 42. So the rate of speed is not an issue. Only the fact that the officer observed that the appellant's vehicle was driving faster than the speed limit, not particularly that it was 42 in a 35 mile per hour zone.
You can continue answering the question, please.
And what the reasonable articulable suspicion standard is substantially lower than proof beyond a reasonable doubt or even probable cause. We just need to show the objective belief by a peace officer that the defendant was going over the speed limit. For example, in any speeding case where rate of speed is at issue, the state needs to prove, for example, if someone is charged going 80 in a 60 mile per hour zone, the state needs to prove that the person was driving at 80 miles per hour in a 60 mile per hour zone. To do that, we will go through all of those requirements in 169.14 subdivision 10. requirements 1 through 4. In this particular case, we know that appellant already stipulated to 3 of those requirements. And the only requirement that they're challenging is requirement number 4, is that the device was tested by an accurate and reliable external mechanism, method, or system at the time it was set up. We know that there are exhibits of the certificate of calibration and the tuning forks for the unit that was used by the officer to clock the vehicle. And there is also a yearly indication that the unit was tested on the yearly basis beginning in 2015. But not only that, you don't even need to determine that the radar was working properly. The officer in this particular case also indicated in his police report that he confirmed the speed reading by looking and pacing the appellant's vehicle. In other words, positioning his vehicle at a set distance between him and the appellant's vehicle and looking at the officer's speedometer. Even if the court determines that somehow the speed reading was all wrong and somehow there was no indication whatsoever that the appellant was even speeding here, mistake of law, so long as it's reasonable, does not invalidate the stop. In this particular case, because counsel already stipulated to the fact that the officer was trained in the operation of the radar, so specifically trained for speed enforcement, we know that the officer could have just estimated it visually, and visually, so long as he objectively believed that the appellant's vehicle was going over the speed limit, that would be enough under the case law to determine that there was reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant.
There are just 2 things that I'm planning to touch on here in my rebuttal. One is trying to help give the court a little bit more context about where that video begins. And one thing that I think is helpful is that at the very beginning of that video, where it starts, on the right-hand side, you can see a car dealership. And at the top edge of the map that was submitted as Exhibit A, you can see clearly that there's a Hastings Chrysler Center, Chrysler dealer, right there just north of 33rd Street, near where the highway becomes more divided based on the map there. Again, you can see that Chrysler dealership right when that video starts, and that gives us some context of when the video starts. And importantly, it shows that it starts prior to the vehicle ever reaching 24th Street. Even though 24th Street is not on this map, we know that it's somewhere past where that Chrysler dealership is, just because of the order in which the streets progress on the map that we do have.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at the map. I'm showing you this map, which is the exhibit. You're saying it shows a dealership?
So on the very top edge, I guess I have a color copy here, but on the very top edge.
Oh, on
edge,
the top. Okay, great.
Yep, so the very top edge, the northern edge, I guess it would be, there's a Hastings Chrysler Center just to the right of Highway 61.
Thank you.
And so again, I think that provides context for where that video begins, and important to our arguments that it begins prior to any alleged curb strike or any findings of fact related to a curb strike.
Why do we know that? The curb strike was at 24th Street, according to the report. I don't see 24th Street on the map.
Correct, and maybe it's a bit of an assumption, but in looking at how the streets progress from 33rd Street and off to the left, we can see 31st Street. It's reasonable to assume that 24th Street is going to continue in that progression as he continues to drive north all the way up to 18th Street, where it was stopped. So somewhere between that Chrysler dealership, when the video starts, and when the stop happens at 18th Street, 24th Street simply has to be in.
I see. It would be captured by it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
The other thing that I did want to touch on, again, is that speeding statute that we've been discussing is one of admissibility. It does not state that these are the requirements for a conviction, as the state continues to argue. It's about admissibility in any prosecution where speed is relevant. This is a prosecution and speed is relevant.
Do you have a case that says that?
Case that says what?
That says that is what it means, the statute means when it talks about where speed is relevant.
I don't know that any case is needed because the plain language of the statute states that this is a statute about admissibility in any prosecution where speed is relevant. The plain language does not say that this is what's needed in a trial in order to obtain a conviction by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The plain language of the statute makes clear that this is about admissibility. And the statute, the cases that have been cited, I haven't seen any cases from the state or my own cases that make that statute out to be something about what's necessary for a conviction. While some of those cases, at least that I cited, did deal with trials solely on the issue of speeding, Olson in particular makes clear that this statute creates an admissibility standard.
Ms. Schwartz was very focused on the term rate of speed in the statute. And if I understood her argument correctly, she was suggesting that the specific number was maybe not relevant here, where evidence of speed was admitted to establish a reasonable and articulable suspicion of speeding. Do you have a response? Did you understand that argument? And do you have a response to it?
And so I think what they're attempting to argue is that when we're dealing with reasonable articulable suspicion, do you really need to meet some standard of admissibility? And I think that you do. Because this is a clear admissibility requirement. So before you can even consider that as part of this reasonable articulable suspicion analysis, it has to be admissible under whatever statutes or rules might apply. It might be different if there was actual officer testimony and he made some actual claim of, based on my training experience and observing vehicles in lanes of travel, I can estimate speeds. Then maybe we're dealing with something different. But here we're dealing with speed that was measured by a speed measuring device, and that's what this statute speaks to, is when that type of evidence is admissible.
Ms. Schwartz also pointed out that the officer noted in the report that he paced the speed of the vehicle. I mean, do we even need to consider the other speeding evidence given the evidence of pacing?
So I think the issue with the pacing evidence is really the same as any of the radar evidence that has come up here. Because a speedometer is still a speed measuring device and thus falls under all these requirements that we've been talking about just for admissibility. And if it's not admissible, then it cannot be considered as part of this analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing today on the very helpful to us, and the case is submitted and we will have a decision out in the statutory time period.